to the first ever Superposition podcast. This has been a conversation and a dream in the heart of Reverend Dr. Christopher Benick, who is a co-host of this podcast. And we've been dreaming about getting together to talk about the impact of technology, the divinity of technology, and the creativity that flows out of that. And what a privilege, Christopher, to finally be here. I can't believe we finally pulled it off.
Yeah, I have a t-shirt that says Achievement Unlocked. I was actually going to wear that today because I feel like we've accomplished something just by starting. So that's great.
That's great. They say that's the hardest part. So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. That's right. We'll see.
But yeah, what a privilege to sit here. I think just for the context of everyone listening with us, would you mind just explaining a little bit what Superposition is? But before you even do that, explain what the parent of that, Co-Creators, is.
Sure. So I don't know. I don't even know how many years it's been now, but numerous years ago, after I finished my doctorate of ministry and science and theology, I had some press, and I had started having people call from all over the world to ask me about how their the tech that they were working in or the science field they were working in, how that related to theology. And what I realized is, I mean, people would call about, they were working on VR and they wanted to know, they would say, my mom was Catholic, so what would she think about this? Or, you know, they were working on something in genetics and they would say, so, you know, ethically, like, what's the church think about something like this? And what I realized after those conversations was that there was a ministry in that. And so we eventually started Co-Creators, and our slogan for Co-Creators is better tech, better people, or better people, better tech, better world. And so, and the goal of that was to start to minister to people who were in tech, but also to start having deeper conversations about it from a theological standpoint, to be able to help to integrate some of those conversations into the general public. And then as people ideate with that, to help them with their ideation to create products and services that would allow them to better the world and better humanity. And so Superposition was actually, we call it the first digital magazine that deals with theology and technology. And so we started working on creating content for Superposition, and our tagline was reality changing observations. And so that's what we do with Superposition. We essentially take concepts and we bring them into reality for people and hopefully change their perspective. And kind of the theology behind that is the fact that I think at a very basic level, everything that we experience in the world, everything we experience in the cosmos, ourselves, our stuff, is all divine technology. And we're called to be co-creators, caretakers, stewards of that technology. And so the hope with Superposition was to kind of take that hermeneutic and have people start looking at the world and saying, well, how are we supposed to be stewards of this, co-creators of it? And so that opens up for us as we have conversations to really talk about anything. But obviously our primary things that we're interested in are theological issues and technological issues, or scientific issues that go along with that. So,
awesome. And for those listening who want to check it out, it's at superpositionmagazine.com, where this podcast will live in the future as well. So with that said, Christopher, tell us a little, or take us down the journey of really the purpose of the podcast and what we're seeking to do with this.
Well, to kind of in a nutshell, I think it's to start to explore the intersection of theology, technology, and science as they pertain to kind of our contextual situations. And so, our goal with this is at least for the time being, is to be able to introduce ideas that we see floating around the interwebs and then to bring them here and to have conversations about it. And so really our format, at least for the time being, I think we'll probably introduce things as we go along. And because the truth is we're co-creating as we are making this thing, but I think the format will be at this point is we'll go back and forth with article ideas, and so I know we've come up with some different ideas, and maybe we could just get right into that. I know you had an article you wanted to start with.
Yeah, I did. Thank you. I think just to set the tone for the conversation and to give some context, I want to share a little bit about the thinking that, or the conversations that you and I have had in the past, really thinking about the challenges that we anticipate or forecast in the future as we think about artificial intelligence and we think about the automation of workflows and workforces. What was interesting as you and I have had these conversations before, I stumbled upon an article recently that talks about the same issue, or it tries to ask certain questions leading down that road. And so there's an article on Wired magazine that was published with the title, "If Robots Steal So Many Jobs, Why Aren't They Saving Us Now?" by Matt Simon. And so the foundation or the premise of the article really talks about how, you know, we've been talking about this fear that we have as a society that AI or automation will steal our job and put us out of work, and it would radically impact the way the economy works as a whole. And so the article really delves into that and starts asking the question, you know, if that was our fear and that was the road we went down, why is the economy shuttered? Why have we ground to a halt, and why aren't the machines getting us out of this? And it's an interesting question, but I think there's a couple of thoughts that came to mind as I was reading this and thinking about this. The first was that even in this process, it's a fair question to ask, but the big challenge I think we see today is not so much the shuttering of manufacturing or the fact that certain industries have ground to a halt. It's the fact that people are being laid off from work and people are unable to work because of this catastrophe that we find ourselves in with the novel coronavirus. And because they're unable to do what they have been doing vocationally or professionally, they're not able to spend money within the economy. And so the article actually covers some of that, talking about how about two-thirds of the U.S. economy is driven purely by consumer spending and just the impact that will have. And I think as we extrapolate this challenge that we see with novel coronavirus today, forcing people not to work, a parallel can be drawn, I think, if we think about the future in terms of how artificial intelligence, robotics, and automation will inevitably affect the way we work. It will have the same sorts of implications. And so as I was reading this, it just reminded me, I think, how absolutely unprepared we are as a society and as a church to deal with the fact that there will be, as there is now, a large portion of our population that is unable to generate an income and the implications that might have. So I found that really fascinating. I found that also really worrying. And I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on that, Christopher. Oh, you're.
Yeah, I think part of the issue is that I think part of the issue is people have an interesting concept of artificial intelligence, right? They like, I don't, maybe they've watched too many episodes of Westworld or something, you know, and they or too much Battlestar Galactica, and they just think that, you know, AI is going to do things the way humans do it. And that's not necessarily the case, right? And so, so part of it is we anthropomorphize like robots in a way in our mind where we assume they're going to do the things that we would do the way we would do them. And that's not what we're really dealing with. So the question is, well, why aren't they doing this now? Well, actually, I think what's going to happen is, I think, you know, because we have a global pandemic, which, by the way, yay to us for starting a podcast in the middle of a global pandemic. You know,
timing is everything.
Never a better time. So, you know, because we're in the middle of like a global pandemic, and if actually enough people cannot go to work or worried about going to work, or a lot of people got sick, I think what it's going to do is force manufacturers to actually speed up having the conversation of automation, right? So if you're a factory and you depend on people right now in a way that could be automated in the future, well, then certainly with coronavirus, you're going to be thinking, well, why wouldn't I automate so people have to, you know, practice, you know, social distancing from one another. And, you know, we automate in a way where people don't actually have to work with one another. So I think that's going to happen more and more. And then realistically, like the projections on automation isn't on, when they talk about robots taking our jobs, you know, there's certain things that robots aren't going to do immediately, but the projections on this, which I think there's some conversation around, but at least the best projections that I've seen, you know, are saying 11 to 22% unemployment by 2030. So 10 years from now, to have 11 to 22% unemployment. So if you think about what's happening right now, the challenge with that is, right now, you know, we're throwing $2 trillion at it as a country or whatever, because we believe that there's an end in sight, which actually with coronavirus, that end may be like 18 months. So I don't know how much, you know, someone getting $1,200 is going to, you know, and actually on a bigger issue, I would even say when you get into that, like, I know they've held off people getting evicted, but that doesn't answer the problem when they can actually go back to work and then they owe a year worth of rent to somebody. Well, what's going to happen then? How long do you think it's going to be before people get evicted then? So these are like band-aids. Nobody's looking at these things from a systemic standpoint, I don't think. But you know, 11 to 22% unemployment by, you know, 2030, that's just the beginning of the automation piece. So that doesn't mean the percentage changes, and it doesn't mean there won't be new tech jobs, because there certainly will. But the challenge becomes now trying to get people to actually, you know, be trained in a way to do those jobs. So how that impacts the church is, if you are a church and you don't have a sustainability plan outside of the giving plate, you're dead meat. I mean, it's just over for you, because you lose 22% of your income, and that's the starting place. You know, the vast majority of churches in the United States are under 100 members, and a lot of those places struggle to pay just their overhead and to pay for a pastor. So that means that it's going to radically change the church. So while I think right now, you know, it's great to see some of the things that are happening in the church, you know, from the standpoint of what's going on with COVID-19, it's well needed and, you know, adapting quickly. Maybe it will actually, it'll do one or two things. It'll either get people to start moving in a direction where they can actually create some digital giving, and they can create a value proposition that's bigger than just their local community. But it also is going to get people, I think, having conversations to say, okay, so what happens? Like, what happens to our church if you have automation happen and you have something like COVID-19, you know, COVID-20, you know, COVID-30 or whatever it is by then, right? Like, so what happens when you have that? Like, where are we going to go and what are we going to do? And I think the church is wildly unprepared for those conversations. I mean, everywhere I go and talk about automation to people, it's like, whoosh, like just right over their heads. They have, yeah. Most people have not thought about that. Literally at our national gathering and the Presbyterian Church, I brought up whether we should do a study on it. And one of the representatives there stood up and said, well, why does the church need to worry about unemployment? I'm like, are you kidding me? Like for a whole bunch of reasons. One, because you're trying to care for the people that you're, you know, two, you're going to not have the option to care for them in that same way anymore. So, yeah. It, you know, that may look like the church becoming something different. And my concern is like, look, Jesus's church is going to go on. It's not going to disappear, but, but are we going to lose the institutional leverage that the church has created, which is a huge advantage for us right now. And so those are conversations that I think we got to have more and more. So.
Absolutely. And I think at the end of the day, the result that we see today of COVID-19 and the effects of the virus globally, this effect is the same thing we will see on a grand scale of automation. Again, the fact is the reason why everyone is panicking, the reason why economies are in turmoil and national governments don't know how to deal with this is not only the health implication, but also the implication of people who are not economically generating something for themselves, which creates a burden on society, which creates implications on spending. I mean, if money doesn't move through the economy and it becomes stagnant, that in and of itself has exceptional challenges above and beyond the health issues we're facing now. So I want to
and I wonder with that, like, so say you get $1,200, right? The question is right now, are you going to go out and buy something with that? Not right now. You're not going to a store. So if you don't buy it online, you know what I mean? And I would guess most people are going to be more inclined to actually tuck that away or pay for a bill or pay for their rent. They're not going to, you know, no one, who wants to be 12 months behind in rent? Nobody, right? Like that's, I don't think anybody wakes up with that hope, you know? Yeah. And it becomes a bigger problem.
But the $1,200 is not a stimulus package. It's keeping us alive. That's what.
Well, my question is, when we come out of this, like, are we going to actually move towards, are we going to move towards something that where the government actually tries to encourage technological development and growth? Because you know they're spending. If they would have spent $2 trillion in technological development over the last. Over the last couple of years and put that stimulus in and actually encourage people to create startups and work towards improving the digital economy, for example, we would be in a very different situation. If we put that towards intentional retraining programs, and that's something where churches could help, you know what I mean? Churches have space for people. If churches were equipped to do this, they have people who are volunteers who actually care about a social good. And those are places that, where they could be helpful. But that is going to take a paradigm shift in thinking right now. And you can tell just by what our government is doing in the U.S. that's not their focus right now. Right now they're trying to put a Band-Aid on something. And I don't think it helps that we're in an election year. Because everyone's like, they're pandering at the same time, right? So it's like, hey, we're going to put a Band-Aid on this, but elect us, right? Yeah. And it's not our fault.
And a part of the challenge is everybody is trying to find solutions for now, while I think the solution to this is not a Band-Aid, as you say. This isn't a short-term solution. So unfortunately, nobody likes the long-term solutions, whatever it might be. But that's what we need to be talking about. But okay, I think that's good. And just to add two stats to that I found interesting as well. I have a stat here from fast food workers in 2018. 3.7 million people in the U.S. are employed as fast food workers on some level or another. And I mean, that today is at risk. We see automation entering that sphere already. It might not be as prominent in the U.S., but I've definitely seen that in other places in the world where a McDonald's would be using, a mechanism.
A self-checkout, right?
self-checkout, self-ordering. I know that they're experimenting with, or some of the fast food restaurants are experimenting with just having a manager where the machines make the burgers, they flip the burgers, they, you know, it goes on a
assembly line. Yeah, look, if they automate a McDonald's, why wouldn't they?
Exactly.
I mean, why wouldn't they do it? You know, and they could probably cut down a lot of space usage and a whole bunch of different things if they could do that. And it's the same thing. It's like my wife and I had memberships at Sam's Club, and we go to Sam's Club. And when we first started going, there were 13 registers with humans there. Now there's 2 registers with humans, wow, and the rest are automated. And you have one person who manages those other, you know. So you see it. You know, people who are in the finance world, they see it left and right, because they saw it when in banking, when everything turned to ATMs, right? So, but now we're like at this exponential increase where things are being automated all the time. So the challenge is for the general public, they're not seeing the insides of all of our factories. They don't understand how many little things are being automated. But I mean, even just think in your house, if you have any kind of, like Google Home or any of those, you know, mm-hmm. Amazon, smart devices. Right. Smart devices, that you can talk to, it automates that process. We have all sorts of internet of things, kind of things going on in our house. It's absolutely. My Roomba's starts, you know, sweeping my floors at 9 a.m. every day. Right. So it's like, I don't have to do that anymore. I just have to empty them when they tell me it's time. Right. So like, that stuff's great. I'm glad. If I don't have to sweep my floor, I don't want to sweep it. Right. If I don't have to manually write down a grocery list, cause I can tell my AI friend to do it, then great. But those are, you know, if I want to, I sometimes wonder why I ever spent time turning lights on and on manually, right? it's a complete waste of time. And so those things are all great. They're fantastic. But, if your house is on your thermostat, it's nice to come home to the right temperature and those kind of things. But so those things people don't care about so much, but once they start kind of moving towards more and more jobs, and it's a big thing even in medical, a lot of surgeries now, right? I would bet after this, medical will even go more. Like if you could stick someone on a table and have them taken care of by something, you know, to deal with their coronavirus, and monitor them, you know, more extensively than a human could right now, and you don't have to risk yourself in that situation, why wouldn't you do it? And so it's crazy. So
what a world, what a time. Goodness. Okay. Well, I think that's a good encapsulation of just the challenges there. Take us through an article that you found interesting this week.
Sure. So there's like a lot of interesting stuff going on with the church, right? So I don't want to talk about this article, but I just think it was an interesting one. Like I saw National Cathedral found 5,000 face masks stashed in a crypt on their property. Oh, wow. And apparently took these respirator masks and had them checked out to make sure they're okay. And then they donated them to hospitals there in DC. So I thought that was really like, okay, that's strange. You know, it's not normal that you have respirator masks, I guess, hanging around the crypts, but they did in this case. So, so who knows? So the church has all sorts of weird stuff going on like that. But I think the big thing, and I've seen a bunch of this, is there's been questions as to, when is it appropriate for people to stop having worship? And I think a lot of people have done that, but one pastor in Louisiana was defying the state orders essentially. And his argument was, now in Miami here, they've closed everything down for the most part. So you can't go into the Gap or whatever you'd want to go to shop. You can essentially pick up food to go, and wow, you can go, we're at stay at home, under stay at home, shelter at home, mandates now. And so we're allowed to leave to exercise or to kind of do basic things like you need gas. It's not too restrictive in that regard, but the parks are closed, the beaches are closed, the docks are closed. And so what this pastor in Louisiana was saying was, look, if until they close these other businesses, the church provides an important service as important as any of these other businesses. And so we shouldn't have to close. And he said, once you mandate that this other stuff has to close, then we'll close, which I actually, we closed our church early. I mean, compared to some churches here, big churches, if you were over 1,000, you were pretty much mandated to close. And so a lot of churches closed pretty early on. And then the smaller churches were kind of having debates about whether to do that or not. So it was interesting that this person had this, but now there's other stories coming out now about pastors and churches that continue to meet, and they have actually been infected with coronavirus.
Oh, goodness.
And actually on Yahoo today, there was a story about a 91-year-old church person who died of coronavirus as a result of contracting it at a service. And so, you know, the big kind of ecclesiastical questions that are being asked is like, well, what are our options and what should we do? And what I see a lot of people doing is they have moved to live streaming. Mm-hmm. Now, people who have never done live streaming before, right? So, Sure. So it's one thing if you're a church and you've been live streaming for a long time, you've invested the money in that. And, you know, a lot of bigger churches have pretty professional looking studios and things that they're using. But if you're a little church, if you're a small church and you've not invested in those things, this becomes a real trying time, right? Because all of a sudden now you are cut off from people in the way that you normally communicate. And for a lot of people, they see their pastor on Sunday morning, and that's the only time they see him. And particularly in smaller churches. And so this has really forced people to have a conversation about, well, what are we going to do? And what I see people doing is throwing stuff up on Facebook. They're on Facebook Live, you know, they're holding their phones up and doing their sermon or whatever for the week. Yeah. And you know, that's fine for kind of a time of triage maybe right now.
Yeah.
But my question becomes, and kind of what these articles have, you know, made apparent to me is, you know, large churches, and I saw another article that specifically in the title, it said large churches use technology to connect with their parishioners, but small churches need to have sustainability plans. And right. If this is more than a couple weeks, like pretty much in our presbytery, and I think the Catholic Church, even globally, they've pretty much said, look, Holy Week's not happening. It's going to have to be digital. It's not going to physically happen at the church. So what happens if we start talking 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 months that we're not allowed to physically meet? So economically, you have a disaster for most churches. And I think I am not sure that the streaming services are what's going to fix that for people, because they're very one way, right? So you see the people, they're preaching, but there's not a real engagement of the congregation in any way. So sure. I think churches have, small churches have an advantage. Mm-hmm. So their advantage is that they have the opportunity to actually, if you're in a 10,000 person church and you're not structured, you know, and in some excellent fashion, it's very hard for you to reach out to every person in your congregation personally. Yeah. In a small church, if you're in a smaller church, there's no reason that you can't reach out to everybody. And that doesn't mean the pastor has to do all that work. That's why you have congregants. That's why you have deacons, elders, whatever your board constitution is, right? To be able to reach out to them. But the question that I have is like, well, I think pastors have gotten bad about asking for money. I think they're not good about it. They don't necessarily create relationships with the donors that keep the church going.
Sure.
And you know, I look at giving, you know, that's, some people have gifts to do other parts of ministry, but giving is a real gift that people have or they don't have sometimes. Yeah. And then I think more kind of, to the point, worship becomes a lot more difficult because if you're sitting on the other side of a screen, you're not in a congregation. So obviously, right, you're not sitting next to somebody. And so you don't have the pleasantries. You don't have someone shake your hand at the door or, you know, elbow bump you now in this culture, right? Or not even touch anybody now, right? Like 6 feet from the door. But you don't have people near you. You don't have people that are singing alongside you. You don't have those things. And so I don't know necessarily that the streaming services help that. So what I think is more helpful is actually creating what I call a digital liturgy. And so this is part of what we've done at our church is we actually, one, there's a lot of pressure on a small church to actually meet at a given time frame. And the data I've seen doesn't show that it's helpful necessarily for churches to meet at a given time frame, because that's not how people consume digital media anymore. Sure. You don't look at Netflix like that. You don't look at, you know what I mean? You don't go through your stuff online like that. You consume it when you have time to consume it. And so why shouldn't worship be that way? And you know, why can't people have that from a digital standpoint, that opportunity to worship? And why can't we give people the opportunity to worship 24/7? That's just been a, you know, limitation of our current time and space. So digitally, it gives us the space to do that, right? So what we did was we essentially set up a digital liturgy where people could, we broke all the parts out of a traditional liturgy. And there's some that I do, there's some that our worship and creative arts guy does. And then what we did is we got on the phone and started calling people to say, hey, just hold your phone up and do this piece of the liturgy. And then we'll add it all together and comprehensively we'll create something. And what we found by making those phone calls was relationally, we were able to start connecting very quickly. So we've already been calling through our role, but we've actually now people are really paying attention. And so, you know, our numbers for being a smaller church, my church is a smaller church downtown Miami. Our numbers were great for our first, for our first go at this, whereas streaming numbers for people, well, that's on Facebook, that gets lost kind of in the Facebook analytics. You don't always even see it. I saw people who were on there and they might have had 10 or 15 people see this. But then, they're not necessarily getting residual views after that. And so this kind of more participatory piece helps people to actually be engaged. But you know, some of this is like your wheelhouse, right? Like there's things that people don't do, even from an advertising standpoint, right? Explain how a church would advertise in a way that's like helpful. Cause I don't think most people understand that.
Well, I think the challenge is as you sit now with a group of people, with a nation of people, really communities all around the world, who have a desire to engage in something that is spiritually uplifting, but they find themselves limited. So I think, being physically locked down or physically disconnected, there is an opportunity for the church to make itself be discoverable online. And I don't think the church has necessarily thought about that. Just talking about, some of what you've said now, we've been so captured in the paradigm of a physical place and time that we've also considered ourselves mostly purely discoverable physically. So the idea of really thinking about digital discovery and engaging digitally has been something that I think a lot of people have just not thought about or invested a lot of time in, and frankly, not needed to have done that in the past.
Yeah, that's fair. But I think because people always say, pastors always say, like, the ministry field is right outside our door, right? They always, but now it's like, well, it might be right through your Ethernet connection. You know what I mean? You're right. So
it really is. Yeah. And so I think that it highlights the potential to now reach people in a new way that, let's face it, has always been there and will always be there regardless of what happens in terms of how quickly we get out of this crisis moment. But there's a lot of things. I think, something that I found really fascinating in all my years doing technology consulting for churches in particular is that many of them, and general nonprofits, but churches in particular, is that they're not aware of a really valuable program that Google has made available a couple of years ago, known as the Google Nonprofits Grant Program. And in essence, what they do, there's a whole host of things, and there's capacity or potential for you to offload some of your digital infrastructure as it relates to email and cloud storage and calendar services into the cloud at zero cost, which for medium to larger organizations and churches, that is an immense value add. And even for smaller churches, you could save quite a bit of money in making use of that program. But what I found probably to be the most profound part of this is the fact that Google has made available $10,000 per month in ad credit to churches or any qualifying 501c3. So as a church, you have this vehicle, you have this free resource to help people discover you in their communities. So it really is.
Most people don't know how to administer that. So that's really the issue, right? I mean,
that's part of the challenge.
And part of it is, you know, if you're a little church and you've got limited staff, I mean, the difference with like a downtown church like ours is for the size we are, we have a pretty sizable staff. And that's because, we're a historic church. We're in downtown. There's kind of the things that go along with that administratively, but we're heavy on the administrative side. Mm-hmm. Most churches, if they don't have to have a ton of administrative things going on, you know, and they're small, then they have a very small program side, right? And that's even like us, we have a pretty small program side. So, you know, finding somebody on your administrative side that understands enough to be able to do that isn't always easy, because they're charged with kind of, you know, your day-to-day physical tasks, or they're creating, basic kind of communications to the congregation, and they've not really looked at that. The question would be is like, you know, every time somebody goes on Facebook, what would be the value of having an ad that's targeted to them, or anytime they do an internet search, particularly in this time of crisis, because, you know, it's like, are people in crisis? Yeah, they're in crisis all over the place. And what we're seeing now is with all these people getting laid off, people are just scared. You know what I mean?
I think in this season, just to say, I think one of the biggest needs that we're going to start seeing more and more and more is people searching. And I don't mean on Google, it could be, but in general, searching for connection and searching for community and searching for meaning above and beyond the four walls they find themselves trapped in. I mean, you know, to be blunt. So I think there is an opportunity for the church to make itself more discoverable in this process, to make itself more apparent to a community that is ever more every day looking for connection, community, and people that they can just relate to. So yeah, I think there is no better time than now to make use of the grant.
Well, and the other thing is the church has all the time I've been in the church, right, has always said, well, the church it is beyond these walls, right? Like, it's not just a building, it's a congregation. Well, what does that mean now for people? Because I think that's totally changed now. It's like, you don't have your building now, right?
The fact is, the church is outside of these walls. It's just that now we can't go outside of these walls.
That's right. Yeah, now we're all quarantined. The church is quarantined.
So I think that makes it a little bit more challenging. But certainly so.
But I also think, like, just even the, and what's interesting about some of these articles is just to say, you know, I don't think people should put the expectation on their church that they should stream. I don't think that's, now, obviously our goal is to preach the word, right? And to articulate the hope and the rescue mission that Jesus has come into the world to give us and to demonstrate for us and to call us to participate in. But how we do that, I think we should be open to being more creative. And so, like, the first week we canceled our services, we didn't have a service. And I got a lot of calls from people, and they're like, what's going on? Are we not going to do anything? You know? And it's like, well, look, we've not I mean, for me, it was a time to say, how are we going to be prayerful? And instead of just reacting, how are we going to actually discern what we're going to do in a way that's sustainable? Because even though we've just pivoted everything digitally, our mission still has to be the same. And so, so then our goal was to have some prayerful time with our staff to say, okay, so how do we pivot so that we're not off mission? And then the other thing is when we come out of this time, what I feel like a lot of churches are doing right now is they're just putting the Band-Aid on. So when we come out of the time, well, we don't have to do this anymore. So we won't do this. We'll just go back to how things were. And my whole point with my staff was to say, look, I think what we really have to think about is how do we only create things that are sustainable when we come back? So let's not create something that we can't continue, because if not, then what we're doing is we're wasting whatever this amount of time is, you know, like, never waste a good crisis. So like, let's figure out how to use this now as the time to actually leverage, because we knew we had to work on things. We knew we had to work on a website because it's just not where it was. You know, we knew we needed to work on digital communication. We knew those things, but they were getting pushed as secondary because we were dealing with the physical issues there. Now there's an opportunity for us to clean all that up, and then for that to help to accelerate our growth, so that we snowball down the road. And I think having those systems, I don't think that's something that people necessarily learn in seminary. I think realistically that there's a practical part of creating systems in a church that people don't know how to do. And without having kind of a systemic overview of your church and a game plan, I think that becomes really difficult. So for me, it's interesting to watch how people have adapted. And I almost wonder if it's interesting to me that this pastor, I think he's got a legitimate point, Louisiana, to say, well, the church is an essential need. Now, the question is that the mission of the church to potentially jeopardize people when we know, you know, that's a different conversation, I think. But then, you know, is some of the hesitancy that he has because he doesn't have a plan? Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of the more interesting thing. I mean, my first thing was we didn't have a service because we had a limited amount. We called it on a Thursday night. We met with our staff on a Friday. And our game plan was we're going to call the most vulnerable people in our church first, the people who would be at risk for this, to make sure they were safe and they knew not to come. And then I wanted to make sure the staff could go and take care of them. Themselves, you know, because toilet paper was just flying off the shelves in South Florida. So you know, like, but so they could
and,
go
and the rest of the world, just to say.
Now, I mean, I think we were trendsetters. You know, I gotta tell you, the thing that I'm worried about the most, I'm not even joking. Yeah. And people need to think about this is a whole nother podcast, but we need to start thinking about what happens if Corona's not fixed, which it won't be, right? And hurricane season shows up in South Florida. Like, where are people going to go? What are they going to do? What do churches do then? Like, if they're they're preparing all this stuff, or they're doing it out of their church, now they're not going to have access to the church. So, like, I'm already looking at, like, hey, what's my mobile setup going to be? Because if I got to, like, you know, live stream from somewhere else, or I've got to do more what I would want to do, create digital liturgy from somewhere else. Yeah. You know what I mean? I want to be able to do that. And so, anyhow.
Well, Christopher, one crisis at a time, please. But yeah, that's fair. I think that's definitely an item we need to add to our list for conversation, because that is, at this point, a very real issue.
Yeah. No, I mean, it could be coming soon.
Yeah. Wow. So just on that, I just want to ask you two questions. So, you know, for leaders in church listening to this now, what can they do to at least align what they're doing? But before you answer that, just to say, you know, I wholeheartedly agree with you that whatever organizations and churches are doing now is something that they need to build with sustainability in mind. I had a conversation this week with a strategic leader of a multinational church. They have campuses in, I think, 4 continents. Really seen some rapid and crazy growth. And in conversation with them, what they had observed as some of their leaders came together to talk about the future, they realized that firstly, this is probably not going to blow over in the next 2 to 3 weeks. And secondly, the fact that this implicates on so many components or elements of our lives means that it will create new habits and it will create new defaults for how we're going to do life moving forward. And so the implication is, you know, if we just think about work, I think that we're going to see a incredible, dramatic shift toward remote work, even when this is resolved. So I think the way we think about work, the way we think about education, for context, my wife is a ballet instructor, ballet teacher, ballerina. And she is, I mean, if we had this conversation 3 weeks ago, she would laugh at me if we just thought about this idea. But today, literally today, she is doing instruction, ballet instruction over video conferences to kids all over the country, because there's no other way to do it. And I mean, if I brought this up 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, she'd say no, people would just go to another ballet studio. But there are no ballet studios right now, right? So it's changed the way we think about things, and it's forced us to change the way we think about things. And I think in this process, we're going to see so many benefits in how we do things differently. I mean, right now it might be uncomfortable, but we're going to learn that some things actually work better. And so my question in that is, as we think just about how radically things will shift, and things are shifting, what advice would you give, really, as a technologist, as someone who's with strategic foresight within the church and technology world? What do you think a ministry can do? If you could say these three things, these are the things you need to look at that can rapidly help you think about the strategy and rapidly help you with execution that is also sustainable. What would those things be?
Well, the first thing I would say is, you know, does your church have a strategic plan? And what I mean by that is not necessarily like, you know, there used to be an old strategic plan thing where you'd go through and, you know, you do a ton of work and people would go get a bunch of data and they would sit down and then they would just kind of make something up, and that would be what the strategic plan was. And they were just going to throw that at the wall and see if it worked. And if it didn't, then in, you know, 3 to 5 years, you come back and you throw it at the wall again. I don't necessarily know that that's been helpful, because I think a lot of that's been data driven. You know, what do people know what their vision and their mission are, as a church? And do they have that strategic plan as far as like, what are the things they're going to focus on? Right. So in our church, for example, when I got there, the church didn't have much structure to it. It was kind of like a new church development in a lot of ways. And so we essentially created what we call foundations of ministry. And so those foundations, we just made them up, but we use it as like, and I use it with my hand because there's five of them. So worship, discipleship, mission, stewardship, and care. And so what we do is we talk about connecting to one another and God and worship. We talk about growing in our discipleship and the teachings of the Lord. We talk about serving through missions. We talk about giving through stewardship of our time and our talents, right? And people don't like talking about the giving piece. A lot of churches don't like it. But what I say is like, look, this isn't about, you want to create a culture of generosity. Part of it is, you know, where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be, right? That's what the scripture tells us. So, you know, if you like to gamble, you're going to be at the track, or, you know, online gambling right now, right? If you like,
I call that the stock market at this point, just to say.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so, and then, you know, like if you like fast cars, you're probably, you know, that's where your money's going to be. But if you're in love with God, you're going to give your money to the things of God, right? To those redemptive things in the world. Yeah. That doesn't necessarily have to mean the church. That can be nonprofits. It can be other elements too. There are lots of good things that are moving forward the purposes of Christ in the world. But those, that's there. And then care, which we talk about, we love one another and ourselves in care, right? So how are we showing that that care for one another? And so what I tell people is like, you look at those various things and you can say, well, you know, maybe you're doing a good job and kind of keeping up with worship, and maybe you're good at giving, but you're not doing much with your discipleship. You're not like in the Bible, you're not studying, or you're not you know, you're not serving other people, you know what I mean? And so those are things you can work on. But if you work on those things, I tell people, I guarantee you'll grow in your spiritual health, because realistically, those things comprehensively help us to grow in Christ. So with those foundations, then, because we have those foundations, so we have a physical plan as to what that looks like. We worship in the sanctuary, right? We call them grow groups, grow through discipleship. So there are small groups, right, that we're working on. We have service opportunities in the community. We have giving, how we volunteer and how we give financially, and we have how do we care for people. Well, then you just take that and you say, okay, digitally, how do we implement it? So then you create a digital implementation of that, right? So then you start looking at each of those things and you start saying, well, how are we going to implement those things digitally? So you don't even need three things. You just need two, really, right? And if you have that strategy and then you are able to pivot and say digitally, what is the most effective way to do it? Well, I would argue care, it's great to see people on Zoom, but you can make a phone call to somebody. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, that doesn't matter whether there's a global pandemic or not. Mm-hmm. Like churches have just been lax on doing that. And I don't think pastors need to make all those calls. I think pastors need to equip people in our church. It's our deacons, who are all lay people, who make those calls. And we have a couple staff people that make them. And we all have people that we, are reaching out and caring for. And that's part of our responsibility as staff, right? But these other things, then we have to talk about, well, how do we implement those things digitally? So there's obviously digital giving, but people have not made a big deal of this in the church, right? We could have still, before the pandemic, we could have talked about giving and about how people should sign up to give online regularly. Don't put money in the plate. Give online. Set it up so there's an auto deposit from your bank account monthly to take care of it, or weekly, or however you want to do it, right? Yeah. So people haven't talked about that. We haven't talked about what's it look like to serve people. There are 7-some billion people in the world. 3.5 of those people are on the internet. 3.5 billion. So that's a lot of people. And 2.2 billion of those are gamers in one way or another. Right. What are the gaming ministries the church has? I mean, we want to talk about mission and evangelism. We've not even talked about those things, right? And then Zoom is one thing that, I mean, if you had stock in Zoom, good for you. Like, you know what I mean? Like that was, people are joked that Zoom is behind the coronavirus. So, but it's been great to actually see people and engage people. And, I have folks that we're trying some of this with our church, they're doing Zoom calls with not just parents, but with kids. And so they have their Sunday schools that are meeting, and the kids love it, right? They see each other and it's using tech, and the kids are more, my 5-year-old's more tech savvy than I am on a bunch of things, right? Because intuitively he knows how to do stuff, because people who make good tech know how to create tech that is intuitive. And then worship, I think it's creating systems that don't overwhelm us so that we can do some of these other things. Sometimes we do so much in the area of worship and we put so much emphasis on it, it doesn't leave us. And this happens with care too. We put, like, if you're in a church where all the care responsibilities are on the pastor, you're never going to grow, because that pastor's not going to have time to take care of, if you're a 100-person church and the pastor has to do all that pastoral care, they're just not going to be able to meet the needs sufficiently. And so we have to have people do it. So the same thing for worship. It's like, and that's why I think streaming for little churches, like if you don't have the equipment, you're trying to do it. One, it's the quality is going to be hokey and it's going to look silly compared to people who can do this to scale. So play kind of to, instead of like guerrilla marketing, play to like guerrilla worship, where people can just use what they have access to, but in a positive way contribute. And those are all easy enough things for people to do, but they have to have a structure in their church to be able to do that. And I just think that, we've not talked about the systemic piece of the church a lot. So that I think that makes that hard for people. But I do think this current crisis is forcing us into that more and more. So with your wife teaching online, are those current clients that she has? Were they pre-existing clients?
Yeah, so they were actually, they were customers or clients that she had been engaging with, at least domestically, over the last couple of years. So there was a relationship, there was an engagement, but at the same time, because of the crisis, there is still a need to remain professionally proficient. And we had to find a way to do that was, you know, healthy and wise as we realized the implications of.
So what I'd be interested in knowing, like long term, not that you have to like, you know, give away the secret, whatever that is, but it's like, you know, as she does this, what's her plan to scale that? Because the first thing I would think is, so, you know, I joke that now in South Florida, traffic's like just terrible. The only place I've been in where the traffic is worse than South Florida, maybe LA, and New Jersey, like New Jersey traffic's terrible. So, but you know, I was joking the other day, there's no one on the roads now. So this would be a perfect time to teach my 5-year-old how to drive. So, but nobody's on the roads now. So if you have to go, things aren't a matter of time, right? It's not a matter of distance. I mean, it's a matter of time. So you might have to go 20 miles, but it could take you an hour and a half or longer to get someplace. Yeah. So my question, you know, that would be interesting to pose to your wife would be to say, does there become a value proposition when people don't have to travel? Because at some point, if I can put, you know, Sally or Johnny or whoever's in ballet class and I can have a digital experience out of my home, that cuts down a whole bunch of stuff. And now all of a sudden I'm not spending, you know, 2 hours, you know, each way to get to a class, you know what I mean? And all of a sudden we've opened up 2 hours or 3 hours to have dinner and actually spend time, or, you know, for kids to do homework or to do whatever the things are that families have to do. So I'd be really interested in that regard, you know.
Just to touch on that, and I maybe in the next session I'll have some feedback on that. But what has been profound for me in the thinking around that is, first and foremost, I don't understand ballet. My wife is working really hard to
teach you how to become a ballerina.
Make me cultured. Yeah.
You're starting with stretching.
So, not even there yet. Yeah. I'm gonna hurt myself.
Good for your wife.
But yeah, she's being responsible in making me a good human being. But what I have learned, just understanding her history in that, I mean, she is zealously passionate about the art of ballet, and listening to her upbringing. Her mother and her father would drive her to the Atlanta Ballet, and she'd be there for 2 or 3 hours, if not more. But it's an hour drive there with traffic in Atlanta. It's an hour drive back. So it's 5 hours of whichever parent took responsibility on that day for 6 days a week.
Yeah.
And it's 5 hours of a day that you know, that parent has now laid at the feet of their child's passion. And I think that's beautiful. But you can get a similar level of instruction, and we'll see the results of this, I'm sure, over the next couple of months. But this a similar you're going to get the same teacher with the same eye and the same everything. It's just a different context. But the parent now has 5 hours.
Yeah.
Extra, right.
Well, and this is the tough thing. Like if you have a little kid home right now, right, you're like, oh my gosh, what am, you know, because I think what parents are realizing is, hey, we didn't know how to parent, because now my child's with me all the time. Right. Yeah. And so, and beyond that, we don't know how to teach our kids how to do these things that we, you know, hopefully we'll start to really see the value of teachers in this. Right. Now that they're home all the time, it's like you start looking at homeschooling kids and you go, maybe they had something there, you know, like maybe everyone needs to be able to be homeschooled. And, you know, again, to this point, like the live streaming versus a digital liturgy, if you're live streaming, from what I'm hearing from parents, we have a school attached, you know, to our church that we run. And then realistically, like they've been trying to live stream a lot of stuff. Parents hate it. And they hate it because that's not how they consume media. What they want is they want to be able to consume media as they do it. And then they want a time, once they've done it, give them a deadline to have their child go through stuff, but they want times to be able to then ask questions on the things they didn't understand. And that's effectively how homeschooling has worked online for a really long time, right? So, I don't know, but lots of good discussions for us to talk about later. I do think one thing we need to put up as a poll is, because you mentioned Atlanta traffic, and I thought, man, Atlanta traffic is really bad. Maybe we need a poll as to where the worst traffic is. Yeah. Where's the worst traffic, and how has it been better by coronavirus?
I'd be curious.
Self quarantine has some perks that we just can't enjoy, unfortunately.
Yeah. They're there for posterity's sake, anyway. Great. Well, thank you so much, Christopher. What a great time together. I look forward to the next conversation, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. You know, as listeners, what you thought about this. So drop a comment.
And if you get a chance, subscribe to us too, because that'd be great. So looking forward to more of this in the future.
Definitely. My name is Duncan Platt. I realize I didn't say that at the beginning. Reverend Dr. Christopher Bennick, thank you so much. And we look forward to the next one.